There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Richard and I had an awesome time down at the World Government Summit this week. We met amazing people and grabbed some fascinating interviews, so fascinating, in fact, that we've put it all together in a special podcast. Total fangirl moment for me. I got to speak to Helen Clark, former New Zealand Prime Minister and ex-administrator for the UNDP down at the World Government Summit. I spoke to her about everything from the dangers of populism to why nationalist strategies don't work.
What the Sustainable Development Goals and the big agenda they're part of, Agenda 2030, do is set a high level of aspiration for the way the world could be. Now, that high level of aspiration has to be taken country by country, really community by community, and translated into action. Otherwise, it's yet another international agenda that people signed at the time and went away and forgot about. And it's important that that doesn't happen. If we compare this with, say, the Millennium Development Goals, which was a smaller, more focused agenda, it was in essence proclaimed at the 2000 Millennium Summit at the UN, but it took quite a lot of years to get traction. With the SDGs, there's been a lot of input into the design of them by governments, by civil society, by academia. Private sectors had an interest. So we're off to a flying start, and we need to keep it rolling. And an initiative like this, which will highlight it, have work streams, have a review every year at the World Government Summit. This is really, really quite exciting in inspiring countries to do their best.
How do you take, though, these very big goals, these universal goals, and make them applicable to different countries? I mean, peace in South Sudan looks very different than a goal of peace in Australia, Canada.
Each country starts at a different point with this agenda. And one of the struggles, actually, is to get developed countries, like the New Zealand's, to see that it's relevant to them. Our society over the years has experienced growing inequality. We've done some terrible things to our water supply. So we've got issues. Now, new government in New Zealand is taking the SDGs seriously. It's also, I understand, looking at well-being indicators to measure progress for New Zealand. A number of the other Western governments, one could instance Sweden, one could instance Germany, have very elaborate sustainable development strategies. But then go to the other end of the spectrum, if you're Mali or South Sudan or Syria, and a lot of poverty, hardship is being experienced, you're in a different space. That's where international solidarity comes in, because the poorest and most conflict-ridden countries do need a hand up. And of course, basic to making any progress at all is that conflicts need to stop.
How well are we progressing on these goals?
It's relatively early days. They were proclaimed in late 2015, but I can say, drawing on my UNDP experience, that already by then, many, many governments were working on them. UNDP, which has been leading the country teams of UN agencies and countries around the world, we saw more than 100 countries ask for support with implementing this agenda. And sometimes it was, in fact, quite often it was, to put the goals and indicators into the national development frameworks, the national strategies. A lot of countries were looking for support on how they would monitor and measure. Not every country's government has good interaction with its civil society, so the UN agencies are a platform where you can bring the civil society actors together with government, because you can't have government achieve this on its own. It needs the NGOs, the communities involved, needs its local government involved, needs its private sector involved.
What would you say to cynics who say that they're too lofty, too idealistic, or even just that there are too many with 17?
I was of the school of thought that said there should have been fewer, and I think that you could have actually got the same meaning and aspiration with a smaller number. But when the member states of the UN negotiate something, everything but the kitchen sink can go in. So we have a very, very large agenda and quite unwieldy. And I think where the international organisations, like my old one, UNDP, can be helpful is in supporting governments to make sense of it. And also, despite the rhetoric that they're indivisible and all interlinked and you can't achieve one without the other, you know, I've been a practical prime minister. I know you can't do everything at once. So you have to sequence and prioritize what you can do. And that's especially true for the least developed countries, which have very little money, huge need. Everything's a priority objectively, but it can't be because you can't fund it. So how do you work out what are the things you should do first in order to have a multiplier impact across the others? Now, if you ask me what is one thing that really is important, gender equality. If you don't have gender equality in your economy and society, you're going to hold the whole society back. If you want to boost GDP, you need women in that workforce and actually contributing and getting the benefits of their labour and remuneration and so on. So there are a number of things which, if you push that button, you will get more results.
It's quite a different environment, though, when these goals were launched than when the Millennium Goals were launched. I mean, you've mentioned inequality there, which has been something there's been growing concern, growing anger. You could argue it's been influencing elections in our country, in the US. Do we need to change the way we look at poverty, which is one of the sort of the zero goals to end poverty for the SDGs, and maybe look more about sustainable growth, fairer growth?
The bottom line of this agenda is that growth needs to be both inclusive and sustainable. And there's a mantra in it that says, leave nobody behind. And a lot of people have been left behind, including in our own country, where this homelessness crisis has developed and the level of child poverty is disturbing for us. Now, you know, if we compare it to South Sudan, of course, it's a different issue, but for us, it's important. So we do have to be concerned about rising inequality. We do need to take steps to reduce it, because that is part of enabling everybody to have the opportunity to fulfill their dreams, and that makes for a happier society.
How much of a concern are some of the populist calls for more trade protectionism that we're seeing at the moment, maybe nationalist agendas over cooperation on things like climate change? How much of a threat are they to the Sustainable Development Goals?
There's a number of problems with populism, in my opinion, and one of them is the simplistic solutions offered, which actually would make things worse. The world actually developed and grew, and people's prosperity levels rose through trade. So you try to put a wall around your economy, your people fundamentally will be worse off because they'll be paying more for goods that someone else could have produced more economically. So it's not helpful to see a reversion to protectionism, which fortunately most countries have not seen as the way forward. Similarly, on the climate change agenda, we need everybody in. We don't have enough ambition in the Paris Agreement as it is. We're told that we should not have global warming exceed 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial level. But the latest count I saw said that the Paris commitments that countries made, if fully implemented, add up to about a 3.3 degree rise. And if you take the US out of it, as Mr. Trump has said, then you go to a 3.6 degree rise. Now, what is that going to do to our climate? We read that this could make life unlivable in parts of South Asia. In the Gulf, without very high standards of living, you wouldn't be alive here because of the intense heat, which can only get worse with climate change. So it is really quite worrying, and we need more ambition, faster, if we're going to make the 1.5 degree Celsius cap realistic.
In part two of my interview with Helen Clark, my former Prime Minister of New Zealand, also administrator, ex-administrator for the UNDP, we spoke about the Sustainable Development Goals in action and also what she thinks of New Zealand's current political scene.
In my lifetime, I've seen the coming of the computer. I remember as a student, there was a huge mainframe computer at the university, and you had to literally punch in cards by hand and feed them into a computer. Fast forward today to what we can do on a cell phone. Now, with every phase of industrialization, from the time the spinning jenny was put out of work by the machine, we have said, where are the jobs going to come from? Woe is me. And with every previous industrial revolution, human beings have been so ingenious that they've invented new work. Now, I'm an optimist. I think we will invent new ways of working and new ways of seeing that people can be carried through when they're in between job opportunities, as it were. But what this needs is huge investment by countries in their education systems, in supporting self-entrepreneurship, in having the social safety nets for those who are caught out. We need to think about this, but don't underestimate the capacity of human beings to reinvent themselves and the world of work. When I was New Zealand Prime Minister, we used to say that 80% of today's five-year-olds will be doing jobs not yet invented. How true that was. You know, 15 years ago, who was designing an app for an Apple phone? I mean, this just tells us how far we've come.
What do you think the single biggest challenge is to the goals as a whole?
I think there are a set of challenges. One is undoubtedly the number of protracted conflicts we have, which has driven the world's biggest ever forced displacement crisis. That's internally displaced people and refugees who number, you know, well in excess of 65 million now. And the ramifications of that have been felt not only in the countries concerned, not only in the neighbourhood, but if you look at the 2015 refugee crisis in Europe, had profound effects in Europe. Profound effects, for example, on the support for Chancellor Angela Merkel, one of the most powerful leaders in the world today, who took a brave stand and in my opinion, the right and the humane stand, but paid a heavy political price for it. So this is a huge challenge. There's also, I think, the major environmental challenges to achieving the goals, the lack of ambition on the climate agenda, and then these widening inequalities we have to be concerned about, because the seeds of further discord, tension, division, unhappiness lie in that.
How do you get the average person driving to work, though, to care about the Sustainable Development Goals?
So what I would say is, as one is driving and looking in the rear vision mirror, think not about where you are in this island of tranquility and prosperity, but what could actually change that? If there's a nuclear war, we're all affected one way or another. If there's a catastrophic change in climate because we haven't done enough, impacts us all one way or another. If there's a major refugee exodus, where are people going to go? Now, UAE is a very generous contributor to good causes, but the price and costs imposed by catastrophic events are going to be starting to drain the pockets of all those who fund good causes, because the price is very, very high. So no country, no community is an island. There's an old saying, you know, if my neighbour's poor, I'm poor too. This is so true. Think of Europe with respect to sub-Saharan Africa. Think of the United States with respect to Central America. Think of New Zealand with respect to the South Pacific. We are not islands. We do depend on living in a world that is equitable and stable for our futures.
How is New Zealand doing, do you think, when it comes to reaching all of these ambitious goals? I mean, we're just over 100 days into a new coalition government. How would you mark us?
Well, I'm hopeful, because I think there have been regressive trends for a number of years. I think that the way in which the housing crisis was allowed to spiral out of control is reprehensible. I think that we need definitely the new measures announced on tackling child poverty, and we very much need more action on our water quality, and the climate change ambition needs to rise significantly. So we have work to do, but so does every Western country. And I would say to the New Zealands and others who are just starting to focus on this seriously now, look at what Sweden's doing, look at what Germany's doing, look at the forward-leaning countries who said, yes, this agenda's relevant to us. It's not a traditional international development agenda where rich countries threw a few crumbs to poor countries. No, it's about us. Are we going to play our part in creating this sort of world by how we act at home?
How are we doing, though, on the gender card? I mean, I was really struck by a parallel when I saw the sign that was widely photographed in the New Zealand press that someone held up when Jacinda Ardern was campaigning, that said she's a pretty communist. And it reminded me of some comments that you've written before about people judging you as a single female on the left. How much have we actually moved on since you came into power as Prime Minister, and now that she has?
Well, again, I think there was a regression, because when I was Prime Minister, we were known for having so many women in prominent places, and it wasn't only the Prime Minister and the Governor-General and the Chief Justice and the Cabinet Secretary and the Speaker and the head of the biggest company and the head of the law profession and accountancy, and on it went. I mean, New Zealand, you know, made a mark. But then it regressed. Now Jacinda has to rebuild it again. There are always people who will say stupid things like what she was subjected to. But I always feel with New Zealand that you have to rely on the basic common good sense of most people who are fair-minded and will give her a fair go. And it's been good to see at the beginning of this year that she's got off to a good start. People are taking a positive interest. They feel, you know, let her show what she can do. That's good.
What do you make of some of the reaction to her pregnancy, though? I mean, reading, I don't know if you read the comments on the online newspapers, but some of the anger about the fact that we had a pregnant Prime Minister. What does that say about us?
Well, overwhelmingly, I think she's been greeted very supportively with this. And I hear a lot of excitement from the younger women who say, what a role model. You know, if she can do it, so can we. You know, we do want to have it all. We want to have a family and we want to have a career and we should be able to do that. And Jacinda's showing that that is possible. So again, I would say, while there will be nasty trolls on these sites, it's not where most New Zealanders' heads are at. I am very critical of New Zealand mainstream media, which let these comments sit on their sites. I do think there should be some moderation to take away the nasty, vicious and vindictive that tend to sit around on those sites. Maybe it's supposed to be provocative, but it's unpleasant. We don't need it.
Should it even be a matter of debate, though, whether or not she can have a baby and do the job?
No, of course not. And when it was raised during the campaign, I leapt on it pretty forcefully and said this is not a question that any man would ever be asked, because the assumption, I suppose, is, and it's ridiculous that we even have to say this in the 21st century, the assumption that people would be making is, oh, well, he will have a wife who will look after the baby. Well, actually, Jacinda's got a partner who said that he's going to give up his job for a year or so and look after the baby. Fantastic. A lot of young women would like a partner like that. So, you know, I think what she's showing is that attitudes are changing, expectations are changing, that women can have it all.
What, and I really don't want to use the word advice because that sounds slightly condescending, but what hard-won knowledge, experience would you share with her around this point, particularly when it comes to working with a successful coalition government?
So I think where Jacinda is scoring very highly ever since she went into the leadership of the Labour Party, leader of the opposition, a few weeks she's Prime Minister, is she's been relentlessly positive. She doesn't let things get her down. She's always upbeat. She doesn't dwell on the negative. The trick with coalitions is to deal with people fairly and openly. If you treat people right, they'll treat you right. And that was my experience with a diverse range of coalition partners. If you deal with people in good faith, that will be reciprocated. And she will.
Are you in touch with her? Do you, I don't know, email each other about your days?
Yeah, I'm in touch. WhatsApp's a great mechanism.
She's also part of a wider trend globally, though, it feels at the moment, for younger charismatic leaders really shaking up the status quo, or maybe I'm just getting old. What does that mean for the world?
So it is exciting to see a wave of younger people taking these positions. To see a great nation like France elect a 39-year-old president is revolutionary, actually. And he's doing a good job from what I can see. You have Justin Trudeau in Canada, who's a phenomenon. A 31-year-old prime minister in Austria. May there be many more, because I think we need diversity in leadership, like we need diversity in everything. And these younger leaders are giving hope to young people that they can be very active in defining their future.
Can't get enough of Dubai Eye. There's more at DubaiEye1038.com.
Also lucky enough to speak to His Excellency Omar bin Sultan Al Alama. He's the new Minister of State for Artificial Intelligence here in the UAE, a very young minister, and in fact the only AI minister in the world. He told me about his ambitious goals for his new role and how he thinks the UAE can use AI as a force for good. 3 months into the job, got put in that position in the last cabinet reshuffle back in October. I began actually by asking him how those 3 months had been.
They've been very exciting. Being the first and only minister of AI in the world, I think, is something that makes it a challenge, because I need to set the ground for others that will come to follow. But at the same time, it is an opportunity. It shows the UAE's vision and leadership in this domain.
What are your big goals? What do you actually see as your mandate?
If I'm going to conclude my whole mandate in one line, it's to ensure that there's a better future created for citizens everywhere, and especially in the UAE. We see artificial intelligence being painted with a very negative tone. Everyone's talking about the jobs it's going to displace. Everyone's talking about the negative impacts. But as with any technology, there's a lot of negative and positive potential there. If governments do not get involved, the challenges will just increase. So the UAE is committed to being part of this discussion in a way that is constructive, to lay the groundwork to create a better future for citizens everywhere. And I think that the potential is there. There's a lot of positive potential that would come out of it.
What do you see as the role of government in this regard?
So the role of government is threefold. The first is attracting the best talent in artificial intelligence. If you have the best talent, you'll have the best applications, the best use cases, you'll have economic prosperity, so on and so forth. The second is putting the policies, the rules and regulations in place to ensure that negative outcomes are limited, or to ensure as well that the livelihood of people is not affected. So we've seen that in the past, for example, drone technology. The technology is great, but because it impacted the privacy of citizens, even at 1%, governments intervened and, you know, made an impact there. So I think the governing part is very important. Now, the third and the most important is putting initiatives in place that ensure that the public is aware of what artificial intelligence is, that the public is actually part of the discussion as well. If people do not know what artificial intelligence is, it will come into their lives in a way that's seamless, but it might have a negative impact even on a personal standpoint. Today we see a lot of concerns on, for example, privacy because of artificial intelligence bots, for example, Siri and others. How can governments address this, and why should governments address this? This is a question that everyone asks. We as a government of the UAE think that it's very crucial and important that citizens feel that they are safe, that they have the privacy, and that this technology is used for their good rather than for the good of others.
And so then we're talking about legislation. What kind of legislation do you think we'll see here in the UAE on AI?
I would rather not disclose any specifics because I want them to get approved first. But we do have a lot of legislations in place with regards to creating banks for people who will be reskilled or retooled in jobs that might be displaced. We have a lot of legislations as well in place that we're thinking of with regards to training and building capabilities even in the younger generation, so in schools and in universities. We're thinking of also putting quotas of our scholarships to be in this domain because we understand that AI is cross-cutting. It goes into every single field. So hopefully as things get approved and they get launched, you'll hear more about them. But there are many exciting legislations that are to come.
The jobs that people expect to be disrupted first by AI tend to involve service positions, a lot of transport labour, things like truck drivers, shopkeepers. Here in the UAE, we're slightly unusual in that a lot of those positions are held by expatriates. How does that affect the way that the government is approaching this issue?
I think that what artificial intelligence impacts is not these low-skill labor jobs on their own. It actually impacts any repetitive job. So any job that requires repetition going in and going out can be automated and can be given to AI. Now that is a challenge that not just expatriates, but every single person in the country will have to face if they are in a job that requires that sort of action. But that also opens up a lot of potential. What if you pair that person with an artificial intelligence that does the boring part of the work, but allows them to be a little bit more creative or a little bit more insightful in their work? I think that is where the potential lies. When the computer first came into our lives, people thought that it was just a typewriter on steroids. It wasn't seen as a serious device that will create the future that we see today. Now we see computing power in our phones, we see computing power in our cars. And as humans, we are at the forefront of this technology. It enables us, it makes us feel better about ourselves, connect better, so on and so forth. Now, artificial intelligence is going to be just that. I think the future of artificial intelligence is going to be exactly or even more so than the future of computers. The people who did not ride the computer revolution when it came, unfortunately, were left out. But the general population was actually part of this revolution. So I think if people are aware and if people do want to be relevant in this new era, they will understand the technology, they will try to incorporate it in their lives, and the potential is endless. They will be the smartest people on earth because they have a device next to them that is able to give them all the insight on the planet, aggregate it, clarify it, and, you know, come up with insights that no one has ever thought of. The potential is endless.
Where do you see AI having the biggest impact on us here in the UAE? Or what are we going to notice or feel the most?
The UAE is mostly a service-based country. We were very good at providing services, both in the private sector and the government sector. We see a lot of AI integration in services in a way that makes the services better, more customized, more tailored, in a way that makes these services, I think, predictive rather than prompted. So before asking for a service, you might get it because there are systems in place that understand your needs, that understand that, you know, you will be coming to renew your license, so why don't we renew your license before you ask for it? I think this will be gradually embedded within the fabric of our service industry in a way that people will see it as a given norm.
How do you do that, though, without it being creepy? I mean, when something I've searched for on a shopping site suddenly pops up as a recommendation on my email, I find that a little bit odd. How do you do it without being intrusive?
You know, we share a lot of data with governments, and we trust governments because we know the moral compass of a government. I am in this country because I understand that the leadership is visionary, that they care about the people, that there is prosperity, so on and so forth. We can't say the same about the private sector, and this is something that a lot of people are concerned about. How do I know that the private sector has my best interest at heart? Now, that's a continuous discussion, but I would rather, and this is a personal statement, I would rather that the government, a proper government, a government that cares for me and everyone on this country, has my data and is able to provide better services for me, than a private sector company that's offshore, somewhere else, you know, looking at my private data. The interaction of government and citizen is also limited to certain spectrums. What you search for on Google goes far beyond services. And I think that is where the challenge is. With government, you understand, it'll be passport data, it'll be some health records if you go to the public hospitals, but things that the government already knows about you. And you're already sharing openly because you trust the government. I think the creepy aspect will not come from governments, but I think that governments should regulate even the private sector that operates within its boundaries.
What you've said, though, is really important when you've said regulate what happens within its boundaries, because the boundaries are dissolving, aren't they, when we're talking about AI and the internet. How does the UAE government regulate something that could be coming from anywhere?
This is a challenge that all governments have, not just the UAE. There's a lot of efforts globally right now on scrutinizing the private sector for these specific topics. You know, are private sector companies players that are global, that are, you know, beyond the law, or should they be governed in a way that, you know, it's like every other company that is domestic in that sense. What I think is going to happen is there's going to be many more discussions. There's going to be many more actions and initiatives that create some sort of movement towards that. The Artificial Intelligence Governance Forum that we created in the UAE and that we're leading today is specifically that. We are looking at, you know, starting a discussion on how we can regulate technology that is cross-cutting and cross-boundary. We have the brightest minds on earth, the brightest people within this domain, coming together to come up with a roadmap for our government and other governments to regulate this technology in a way that ensures the prosperity of everyone.
You're very young. You're in your late 20s. How does that youth help you with the job that you're doing? What's the advantage of having a young minister for AI?
Artificial intelligence as a technology is very young as well. And it's progressing at such a rate that if you're not agile enough, you will become irrelevant in the close future. I think it's not a matter of age, it's a matter of outlook. I am very optimistic about AI, but I'm cautious as well. From my aspect or from my angle, I think that we need to use this technology to create an advantage for the country and an advantage for the citizens. But we need to also put the red flags in place that ensure that if we approach them, there is some sort of mechanism to protect us all. So I think it's not a matter of age, it's a matter of insight maybe. And I'm very passionate about it. I've been very passionate about it for years. And I hope to create a better future and a better life for everyone.
That is His Excellency Omar bin Sultan Al Ulama, the Minister for State for Artificial Intelligence here in the UAE.
Stay up to date with the latest news.
Download the IRN News Centre app now.
One of the big thinkers I spoke to down at the World Government Summit was a man called Callum Chase. He's an AI expert and he's also an author. He thinks that we're looking at a future economy without jobs. And he's written a book about AI and the death of capitalism. I spoke to him about how exactly that would work.
Because it's not clear that capitalism can accommodate a world in which maybe well over half the population is not working. We are probably heading towards a jobless future, and we need to figure out what kind of an economy we can have that will be successful for everybody.
Let's start there with the jobless future. You say that within a few decades, most humans won't be able to work for money. That sounds like it's forced on us rather than being a choice.
I think it's an inevitable consequence of the way the technology is developing. I mean, nobody knows this for sure. I don't have a crystal ball, neither does anybody else. But I think it's most likely that in the way that most drivers are clearly going to be made redundant by self-driving cars in the next 15 to 20 years, I think also most people working in warehouses, working in call centres, and I'm afraid to say journalists and book writers as well, are going to find that machines can do our jobs cheaper, better and faster than we can.
How do governments even start addressing that?
I think at the moment we're right at the beginning of thinking how to deal with this. So I think we need a lot of smart people thinking about what an economy could be like that could handle that, that could make everybody happy. I think we have a great opportunity. A world in which machines do all the jobs could be a world in which humans do the interesting and fun things. But we don't know what that economy looks like.
But then how do we pay for the necessities in life? Roof overhead, breakfast on the table, if we're not earning?
That is the $64 million question. My personal view is that the usual answer, which is universal basic income, is not the right answer. I think there will always be some humans working. So a universal system which gives money to those people as well as everybody else is a waste of money. Why would you give money to Mark Zuckerberg? And the other big problem with universal basic income is that it's basic. We have to do much better than just give a basic dole income to the majority of people. That society would be a failed society. So UBI, I don't think, is the answer.
So what could be?
I think the way to make it work is we have to reduce the prices of all the goods and services that you need for a very good standard of living to close to zero. And if we can do that, then those people who are working and those people who have lots of assets can be taxed in a non-punitive way to pay for everybody else to have a really good standard of living.
There's a lot of talk about reskilling, a lot of investment going into programs that will see people reskill. Is this enough? Will we eventually just all turn into tech developers?
No, I don't think we'll all turn into tech developers, and I don't think we should want to. I don't think reskilling is going to work. Now, I have the view that a jobless society is coming and it's inevitable. I may be wrong. Lots of people are absolutely convinced that we will all carry on working. Personally, I think those people are pessimists. But if I'm right, and we are going towards a jobless society, there's simply no point in trying to reskill everybody. Education is very important to live a life of leisure. So I think in the future, that is going to be the key role of education, to give everybody the really good depth and breadth of understanding of the world so that they can make the most of their lives of leisure.
You say that people who think we can reskill are pessimists. Work's good for people in all sorts of ways, though. It gives you a sense of purpose. It gives you a sense of achievement. I mean, I'm thinking of the hierarchy of needs. There's a lot of emotional functions that work performs.
I think humans will always work. It's hardwired into us. I just don't think we'll get paid for it, because a machine will, for most people, be able to do whatever they could do for money cheaper, better and faster than they could. So humans will create new projects for themselves, new work for themselves. It might be to become the best golfer that they could become, or the best painter, or the best writer of books about AI, or the best interviewer of people at world government summits. All these things could be great fun if you don't have the pressure of having to make money at it. So I think we'll always work, we just won't always do jobs.
You used to live in Dubai. You were here in the 80s with BP. Dubai is quite keen to become a forerunner in AI. We have an AI strategy. We have an AI minister wanting to attract tech and development and the Brains Trust here. What do we need to do to do that?
Oh, I think probably maintain the forward-looking mindset that the rulers and the people here have. When I was here in the 80s, Dubai was a tiny, tiny fraction of what it is now. I was very impressed already then with how forward-looking the people were and how much it was growing. And in my lifetime, it has grown enormously. It's now a mini Manhattan. That attitude, that approach will see the UAE and Dubai very well positioned for the future, I think.
What's the best things we could do now, though, at a private sector and a public sector level? What do we put in place now to make sure that the AI story becomes a positive thing for humanity, not a negative.
There's lots of issues that people are worried about rightly right now with regards to AI. So privacy, transparency, bias, these are all knotty problems, and we need to be discussing them and working on them. But the thing that I think is most important is figuring out what this economy of joblessness could be like. We haven't started to think about it. A lot of people, people in the governments of the West and people running the tech giants, are in denial about it. I mean, Google's chairman, Eric Schmidt, to take one example, says he is a job elimination denier. I think we have to get past that mindset and start really thinking hard about that issue. That, to me, is the number one most important issue, because if we get it wrong, it could crash our societies.
And that is Callum Chase, artificial intelligence expert and the author of Economic Singularity, AI and the Death of Capitalism.
Can't get enough of Dubai Eye? There's more at DubaiEye1038.com.
Now, Richard wasn't just covering the World Government Summit. He wasn't just down there getting interviews. He was also one of the star attractions. Well, he was hosting a panel, a very distinguished panel full of expert expo thinkers.
That's right, and one of those was the global CEO of Siemens, the world's 71st biggest company. He's Joe Kayser, and I asked him why they're such big fans of Expo as a company. They've been supporting it since 1851, the first one, the great exhibition in London. But also here in Dubai, not only are they supporting Expo, but when Expo finishes in 2021, Dubai is going to be the new global logistics hub for Siemens on the Expo site. I asked him why.
So, and there's a lot of software companies out there who make you try to believe, or who try to make you believe, this is all about software. This is all about virtual reality and artificial intelligence. And but you know, the fact of the matter is, there will always be hardware. There will always be molecules, whether it's us or carbon molecules, or whether it's cars or furniture or homes or any sort of hardware. And what the industrial internet actually does, it makes the engineering and the manufacturing of that hardware more effective, makes it more flexible. And one of the things, if you look at it, one of the things which is going to be massively impacted, positively impacted by this whole industry 4.0 or 4.0 revolution, is logistics. So logistics is probably one of the most attractive ecosystems in the future of manufacturing and engineering. So you would think, okay, where does logistics happen? Well, it happens on the most modern ports. It happens on the most sophisticated airports, which are big and good and efficient already. And if you kind of scan the world, I mean, naturally you arrive in the UAE. It's politically stable. It's very well advanced already in infrastructure. It is open to protect IPR, and it's got good talent. Which is, you know, available to make it work, because if there is no people, there is no talent, and if there is no talent, there is nothing happening, except a lot of big plans which get never done. And that's why we said, hey, this is a good opportunity to announce that plan and move that from Germany to the UAE.
So Expo was just a catalyst, but Siemens has a long history with Expo, dating back to the first one, the great exhibition in 1851, Werner von Siemens exhibiting, what was it, the Telegrafen Bausenstalt von Siemens und Halske, and you've been there ever since. Why this commitment to Expos? What's the big deal about Expos?
Well, at the time when it started with a great exhibition in London, Siemens was a startup. So there was a young engineer together with his company coming to London and say, hey, you know what? I invented the pointer telegraph. And everyone goes, what? And it turned out that this pointer telegraph was the root, the first device for telecommunication. So you could argue every iPhone which is being done today has its roots in 1851 Werner von Siemens Expo product, which he brought to market. So what that actually tells you is, you know, the Expo is where the world meets. So people from everywhere come to meet, to talk about changes, to talk about what can be done for mankind, and this is just a good place to be.
Let's talk about some of the things that are going to be happening at Expo 2020, and let's talk about some of
problems that people are going to be trying to solve. For example, I was reading your comments just a few days and weeks ago when your full year results came out, and you were talking about one of your business units, which is the power unit, and you said this: the defining market for fossil power generation is not a temporary slump. This speaks to one of the big shifts of our time, the shifts away from fossil fuels to renewable energy. It's a massive shift for this region. It's a massive shift for your company. How is that going to play out?
Well, first of all, we have been talking about the electrification, so the power generation, not so much about the fossil fuel. We talked about what is going to be used in order to produce electricity. That's what we talked about, and you can see today with the rise of renewable energy, you know, making solar panels and wind energy not just competitive in terms of CO2 emission, but also competitive in terms of economic factors. You know, we have seen a massive rise of renewable energy. So with that, you could see that the backup is not used so much for like large gas turbines. It's more smaller backups which can handle the peak demand, which renewable energy cannot do. So it's nothing but the start of a big transformation from fossil power generation to renewable energy, and that we are in the forefront of that, and we need to manage this small transformation.
Two final quick questions from me. The first is about nurturing a innovative and technologically savvy generation, new generation of workers in Dubai and the UAE and the region. You've lived and worked in Germany with Siemens, one of the world's most innovative companies. You spent a lot of time in Silicon Valley earlier on in your career. How does a place like the Dubai, the UAE, anywhere else like it, foster that kind of culture? What's the secret sauce in your view?
I think I'm not sure whether this is a secret. Every economy which has a leadership that has a vision is going to be attractive going forward. You need to show people, you know, where the future lies. And the more compelling that is, the more people want to be part of it. And if there is no vision, if there is no, you know, view about what the future will bring in a positive way, people are not motivated to be part of it. And you could see that in the Silicon Valley, which is a network on its own. We see it in the predominantly in the UAE, but also now coming with the Vision 2030 of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia with the new leadership. So everyone who really wants to bring their countries forward, their society forward, they come up with a big vision and say, by the year 2030, this is what we are going to do. Or like in what Dubai did in a very early stage, and then also followed by Abu Dhabi a bit later, you know, about 20 years ago, they have already been starting out and saying, maybe fossil or hydrocarbons, you know, are going to be a scarce good at some point, so why burn it all and not use it for petrochemical processes, which goes all the way to healthcare, right, in the chemical and pharmaceutical industry. So they had, a long time ago, they had a vision what happens after the oil. So what does Dubai and Abu Dhabi do after, you know, the oil is gone at the time? Today we are talking different things. We said, well, that's forever, but no one should use it anymore because of CO2 emission and what have you. So it is about the vision of the future. Make it tangible and say, you know, this is what we're going to build together. The world's most attractive tourist home. The world's most efficient ecosystem of ports and airports. Or the world's best airline. And so this is a type of vision where you attract people and they want to be part of it. And this is what drives them, what motivates them, that someone's got to show the way on how it moves forward. And that's the secret. And if you have countries which always complain about the present because it's not good enough and it's not great enough and the government doesn't give, you know, subsidies, there's not going to be a future because, you know, people who complain about the past, they are not making a future.
Final question is career advice. You've clearly been very successful in your career. You run the world's 71st biggest company, 350,000 people, 80 billion euros of turnover. What career advice would you give to a teenager looking ahead to their career in terms of what to study, or parents looking to advise their kids on a career path or career choices or education choices?
Well, you know, there's so many crossroads in your professional life. Sometimes you take the wrong turn. Sometimes you're lucky to take the right turn. But what I would always advise kids or younger people or whoever would ask me, I would say, do what you really love to be doing. Don't look at what's in fashion. Don't look at what gives you the most money today. Do really what you think you have a vision in. And if it's sports, then become a sports person. If it is about actor or singing or play a piano, play the piano, because do what you believe you are best in. And don't try to pretend to be someone who you are not and never will be, because people will figure it out earlier than you think.
That's Joe Kayser. He's the Global Chief Executive of Siemens, talking to me yesterday at the World Government Summit.
Stay up to date with the latest news.
Download the IRN News Centre app now.
One of the politicians attending the World Government Summit was His Excellent Imad Fakhouri. Now, he is the Jordanian Minister of Planning and International Cooperation. He was here for a special summit on the Sustainable Development Goals. We spoke about what the SDGs mean for the Arab world, especially when it comes to employment. What needs to be done to get more Arab youth into jobs?
I think the UAE is trying to contribute in a practical way to the global discussion on achieving the Sustainable Development Goals agenda. Since this is a global summit that looks at the way governments need to transform to be more responsive to citizens' needs and expectations, at the same time to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, I think the UAE took a great leadership position to launch a few global councils that could focus practically on initiatives that could contribute to achieving specific SDGs in a way that thinks innovatively out of the box and can contribute to this global debate. One of the things that happen when you build a consensus for, you know, the 193 countries who have adopted the SDGs is you tend to go to a lowest common denominator somehow. So this gives us a chance to think creatively about what is it going to take to help achieve, you know, the different SDGs.
You're going to be chairing the Global Council on Sustainable Development Goal 8. So we're talking there about economic growth and decent work. What's the biggest challenges to that goal?
This is one of the, I would say, ambitious goals, because what it's trying to do by 2030 is very much achieve inclusive, sustainable growth with full employment, productivity, decent work, which is extremely challenging under normal circumstances. This goal is very much connected to all the other goals. It's probably one of the most connected goal, because everything you do in all the other goals is ultimately going to either contribute positively or negatively to the growth agenda or the job creation agenda. On the growth side, I think what we're trying to focus on is that the traditional economic growth models are no longer valid. There has to be a very serious paradigm shift. There is very good now evidence and literature that is pushing the growth models of different countries to move towards more inclusive growth models that are more circular economies, that are using resources beyond the specifics of, you know, looking at just the economic growth rate of your GDP in real terms, which has been, to be honest, a lousy measurement, because it only measured the growth in terms of just wealth created, but it didn't look at sustainability in terms of the patterns of consumption and production and whether it's helping the planet or contributing to destroying the planet, or it didn't look at the distribution side and the inequality side and so on. That's on one end. The other end is, of course, you know, trying to create sufficient employment to meet expectations. And we know there's a big challenge now globally, more importantly in our region, given the demographics, given some of the negative instabilities we have been witnessing the past 5-6 years in many countries. We see that the unemployment rate of youth in general has been 3 times higher than the average national rates. So that kind of gives us a very big challenge to deal with. So you look at the next 10 years, we have to create 100 million jobs in the Middle East and North Africa region at a time when we're barely trying to come back to a stabilization mode not forgetting the reconstruction needs, assuming we resolve politically some of the conflicts we're all witnessing in this region that is impacting the potential of the region and making it even much harder to achieve the SDGs.
Well, one of the biggest challenges to your full employment SDG may actually be taking place in the ballroom of this hotel with you. At the same time as the Sustainable Development Goals Conference, there's a huge working group on artificial intelligence, and everyone I've spoken to there this morning is talking about the effects that it's going to have on jobs and job creation.
Absolutely. So we know for a fact that the reason why youth unemployment is actually increasing is because of the disruption that technology is having. The question becomes, are we going to use these disruptions in a positive way as an opportunity, or are we just going to constantly keep reacting to them and continuing growth and employment policies that are not going to be responsive to forecasting what the future requirements are going to be and changing that? So yes, we are here discussing the transformations we need in the human resource development, for example, value chain, education, the skilling, the skill sets that we need to get our youth into the future jobs that we are starting to see. We're going to have to be extremely flexible and move away from rigid development models, given the disruption we're seeing and the change. People are saying 40, 50% potentially of the jobs we see today could disappear in the next 10 years. These transformations, the global forces, either you take them as a given and you kind of look at ways to make them into opportunities and use them to better deliver services as governments and better equip your own citizens to find the necessary jobs with the necessary skill sets, or do we stay stuck in the 20th century development model?
How does this dovetail with what Jordan is doing? You've got your own economic transformation plan, Jordan 2025. How is that progressing?
Well, it's progressing well. One has to factor in that, given our geopolitical location as Jordan, we've had massive external disruptions. Unfortunately, they are not of our own making, given the instability around Jordan. So we tried to do our best to remain resilient, given these external shocks, and try to look at opportunities to change these challenges into opportunities effectively. So we had to look at a very serious mode to preserve the macroeconomic and fiscal stability of the country. And I think we've actually done a very good job in terms of achieving that, given the circumstances that surrounded us. We relaunched our 10-year development agenda in 2015, which is the Jordan Vision 2025, which is being implemented in successive integrated development plans that the government is actually doing them through 3-year rolling cycles that get updated annually. And we're integrating and mainstreaming the sustainable development goals into these successive plans. And we're trying to measure annually, how close are we coming to achieving these different targets, so that, we can move positively into an employment growth agenda, having absorbed tremendous waves of refugees in the past 6-7 years that have increased our population by 14% and have on average added a burden of about $1.5 billion of direct costs to accommodate 1.3 million Syrian refugees. We've started now the 8th year of hosting them in our country, and that has been a very big disruption to our development model, but we're trying our best to recuperate, come back, and focus now very strongly on the growth employment agenda, given the great opportunities that Jordan presents on the investment side. At the same time, the great complementarity between the Jordanian economy and many of the GCC economies, especially like the UAE, where we find tremendous investment, trade, labor opportunities that are creating win-win solutions for the two countries.
And that is His Excellency Imad Fakhouri, the Minister for Planning and International Cooperation for Jordan.
Can't get enough of Dubai Eye? There's more at DubaiEye1038.com.
One of my favourite interviews from the World Government Summit was with Dr. Jürgen Schmidhuber, who is the chief scientist at a lab called Nascence, based in Switzerland. It's part of the Dale Moll Institute for Artificial Intelligence Research. One of those exceptionally clever people who you just realise is thinking on a different plane than you. He's one of the men responsible for putting voice recognition on your phone. He thinks that robots are soon going to be able to think for themselves. When he was 15, was to develop technology that was smarter than he was so that he could retire. And that's where we started our conversation. I asked him how close we were to that point.
We are not there yet. But yes, this has been my dream since the 80s when my first publications on this occurred. And we are getting closer and closer, and it won't take many decades from now. So I hope I'll live to see it.
What needs to happen, though, for that to happen? What needs to happen for AI to get that good?
Yeah, a couple of algorithmic puzzle pieces have to fall in place. I think we understand most of the important stuff that is necessary to achieve that. We even understand how we can build a machine that not only learns something here and learns something there, but also learns to improve the learning algorithm itself and learns to improve the way it improves, the way it improves itself, and so on.
Which technology at the moment, which development at the moment gets you most excited?
It's different from what gets most people most excited, because how do you know us? You know us from something which is called long short-term memory, which is an artificial neural network, a deep learning method that we have developed since the early 90s in my little labs in Munich and in Switzerland. And this is now on your smartphone and doing, for example, the speech recognition. So, for example, whenever you ask Google, okay, Google, what is the shortest way to the station? Then it understands your speech and translates it into text, which is then becoming a search query for the search engine. And if you are on Facebook, then you can click on the translate button and the text of your friend from Spain is going to be translated into an English text, for example. And again, there is a system which has learned from nothing, which has at its core our long short-term memory, the LSTM. And since 2017, Facebook is using that to do 4 billion translations per day. So 50,000 in this second and another 50,000 now, and so on. So this is how our stuff is now kind of permeating the modern world. And a significant fraction of Google's computational power is used by LSTM to do all the speech recognition on 2 billion smartphones and all the translation for Google Translate and so on. But the most exciting thing is something else. The most exciting thing is something which is not as commercial yet, which is about systems that learn without a teacher, without just slavishly imitating humans. They learn to invent their own experiments and to solve their own self-invented problems, such that they become more and more general problem solvers and exhibit artificial curiosity and learn more and more without a teacher about how the world works and how they can use that acquired knowledge to solve new problems.
If they're not learning from a teacher, where are they learning from?
Through their own self-invented experiments. Like a little baby which learns to understand how the world works by playing around with toys. No teacher, no parent tells the baby how it should move exactly its fingers to grab the little pieces and then build little towers and see when they topple and how gravity works. And so these little babies, they learn to predict what are the consequences of my actions, and then they can use these models of their own actions to select action sequences that lead to a lot of predicted reward, and they will prefer those action sequences over others which lead to a lot of pain. And that's how they are over time maximizing their reward and minimizing their pain in life. And our artificial networks do pretty much the same thing.
But our artificial networks aren't going to feel pain.
But what does it mean to feel? How do you judge whether somebody is able to feel pain? Our little robots can feel pain because they look as if they do. We give them pain sensors, of course, to protect them from their own actions. Because whenever the robot is bumping against an obstacle, then this may not be good for the mechanics and everything. So we give it pain sensors, and negative signals are coming from these pain sensors into this artificial brain, a neural network, an artificial neural network, which is trying to maximize pleasure and minimize pain, which are just numbers. Over time, it's learning to maximize this reward by figuring out ways, by changing some of its internal connections, such that the incoming video and the other signals are translated into action movements that lead to the charging station whenever the battery is low, which is negative symbols, pain signals from the battery, hunger signals, so to speak, without bumping against any obstacles as it is moving towards the charging station. So All of this is very complicated, but in principle, these little learning guys can learn to do that.
Self-learning machines, though. I've been interviewing people about AI all day. One of the people I spoke to this morning was speaking about existential risk. He's donating a lot of money to foundations that deal with existential risk, one of those risks being that the machines become too smart.
I have no doubt in my mind that within not so many decades, machines are going to be much smarter than we are, and they won't be real machines any longer. No, they will generalize what is already happening in my lab, namely they will invent their own goals and pursue their own goals, and of course they are going to realize what humans have realized a long time ago, which is that most of the resources are not in our little thin skin of biosphere around the third planet. No, almost all the resources are out there in space, and so of course they are going to emigrate and make use of these resources. And in the long run, there is no real way of controlling that, and humans won't be able to follow, actually.
If the humans can't control the robots, though, don't we have a little bit of a problem?
Not the type of problem that you see in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, where the bad robots are fighting against the good bodybuilders. Because in the long run, at least, there won't be many goal conflicts between those robots and the living beings. Because you have goal conflicts mostly between beings that are similar. For example, humans are similar to other humans, and because they share goals, they are interested in each other. Only when you share goals, then you can have goal conflicts. When you share goals, you can do at least two things. You can either collaborate to achieve these goals collectively, or you can compete. And an extreme form of competition is war. Most beings are interested in those who are similar in the sense that they share goals, because only if you share goals, then you have a reason to interact. And that's the reason why most politicians are interested in other politicians, and most CEOs of companies are interested in CEOs of companies of the same kind, and most kangaroos are interested in other kangaroos. And most super smart AIs of the future are going to be mostly interested in other super smart AIs of the future, and not so much in the kangaroos and the humans.
One of the things that people I've spoken to today seem to be most worried about is that what the robots will want or will be able to do is our jobs.
The machines don't really want your jobs, do they?
We've got a meeting downstairs of the Sustainable Development Goals next door to where you're all discussing artificial intelligence. In amongst those Sustainable Development Goals is full employment, ending poverty. I'm wondering how that works at the same time as we are developing machine capability to the point where people are also talking about a jobless economy.
Yes, but don't you think it is in our interest that all these difficult jobs that currently can be done only by humans, which are partially dangerous or very unpleasant, that these jobs are being replaced by machines? The orthogonal question is, how does society then react to the technological changes? So in principle, you want machines that can take over the boring and difficult jobs of humans. The next question is how to distribute the new type of wealth.
And before I let you go, do you have an answer for that?
I'm currently living in Switzerland, which is a country that recently had a referendum on the question of universal basic income, and it didn't pass. However, a large fraction of the Swiss thought it's a good idea. I think it was something like 30%. You ask the same question again 20 years from now. Now, who knows whether more than 50% might be willing to say, yeah, that's a good idea.
And that was Dr. Jürgen Schmidt-Huber of the Dalimolle, I can't say it properly, and I know the Swiss aren't saying it like that.
Try again.
Dalimolle Institute for Artificial Intelligence, and now I just sound Spanish.
Stay up to date with the latest news.
Download the IRN News Centre app now.
Now, for me, one of the highlights was meeting the Danish architect Bjarke Ingels, founder of BIG, or Big Architects. He is doing a whole bunch of cool work around the world. One of the things he's doing in Dubai is building a mock-up Mars space station. He's doing it in Mushrif Park in Merdif, of all places. I asked him why this obsession with travel to Mars.
I do think that humans originated, according to what we know, in East Africa. And if we would have not ventured beyond our origins, we would still only be in East Africa. But like every time we developed a new technology, we developed fire, we could go further north, we could cook new foods, we developed boats so we could sail to Australia. So we've always been exploring and expanding. And in that sense, the space between us and Mars is merely just a slightly bigger ocean we have to navigate in order to find new places to live and explore. And just to put it in perspective, 500 years ago when Magellan circumnavigated the globe for the first time, it took him 3 months to get from Spain to Brazil. We can get to Mars in 3 months, probably on a journey that's going to be less dangerous than what it was to sail across the Atlantic 500 years ago. So in that sense, it is really something that is inevitable and will hold a lot of possibilities.
So that is the argument for why space, but there's a specific argument for why Mars in particular. You and others have done a lot of research. What makes you think that Mars is the sweet spot?
No, Mars is, it's almost like a cosmic coincidence that our most immediate, or almost, or at least our like immediate neighbor, Mars, has almost exactly the same day cycle as we do. It's 24 hours and 40 minutes. So you actually get 40 minutes longer days, which I think everybody could use. But just to compare it, like for like on Mercury, a day is almost half a year. So imagine when the sun sets, it's like 3 months until it rises again. So in that sense, that's incredibly fortunate. Then it has the same seasonal tilt, which means it has the same seasons as we're used to, although they're twice as long because a Martian year is 2 years long. It has temperatures that are in the mild range on both sides of zero. So during the summer at the equator on Mars, you have 20 degrees Celsius, but of course it can get quite cold. And then finally, you have all the same minerals and resources on Mars as we do on Earth, including carbon and water, which are the two sort of main ingredients in life. So our most immediate neighbor actually has everything we need to sustain human life.
Okay, so that explains why Mars. You're building something here in Dubai that's laying the groundwork, the foundations for that trip to Mars. Tell us what you're building here and why Dubai is the place to build that.
Yes. So basically we partnered with the Dubai Future Foundation, and you can say like Dubai has committed maybe more blatantly than any other government that I can think of resources to focus on speculating and inventing and even making the future happen. And one of these focuses is the idea of actually creating an Emirate city on Mars by 2117, which means that we have 99 years to make it happen. To make the first step, we're going to make a prototype right here in Dubai, opening within a couple of years, where we're going to use the same techniques as we're currently anticipating we will be needing in order to build a city on Mars. So we're going to create an inflatable membranes to create pressurized environments where we can have a controlled temperature. We're going to use 3D printing with the local sands. So that means that here in Dubai, it's going to be Emirati sand. On Mars, of course, it's going to be Martian regolith. But 3D printing makes sense because since we don't have factories on Mars, we don't have a production apparatus, we don't even want to use like formwork for casting concrete. We want to have the least amount of machinery to make the maximum amount of building, and that's where 3D printing becomes relevant. So essentially, we're going to build the prototype here so that we can create the feeling that in a couple of years you'll be able to go to Dubai, you'll be able to get a sense of what it's going to feel like living on Mars. And of course, in a way to inspire future generations to really want to become the pioneers that eventually make Martians a reality.
Bringing in this all back down to Earth, you run an architecture firm, 500 architects building buildings around the world. I was interested in some of the comments you made about the efficient techniques for construction, for farming, that you would have to prototype before going to Mars actually can make planet Earth a better place. Talk us through those.
Yeah, but I think, for instance, like if we just look at the, you know, hydroponics and aeroponics, which is different kinds of ultra-efficient forms of agriculture, will allow us to, let's say, a typical earthling requires 237 square meters of farmland to feed them. On Mars, we'll be able to do that with 23 square meters per person. So that's tenfold efficiency. Imagine how much that would free up of space, how much it would reduce our footprint just for feeding ourselves. Also, on Earth, we have almost like a billion and a half liter, like cubic meters of water. It's mostly salt water. But we have only 10 million cubic meters of fresh water, but that's still twice the amount of water ice that we have on Mars. So we're going to have to be ultra efficient with water as well. So essentially, all the wisdom, all the knowledge, all the technology that will allow us to create a man-made planet-wide ecosystem on Mars are the very same techniques that would make us capable custodians of the planet we actually inhabit today.
Well, let's talk about that planet. A couple of final questions on some of your projects here on planet Earth. And you say you're trying to rethink architecture and what that means in urban planning. And some of your buildings, like the 8 or the Mountain in Copenhagen, a lot of it social housing has done just that. Explain what you're doing, how it's different, and how it's benefiting mankind.
Yeah, I think in some way, like one of the things we like to remind people is that we should really think about our cities and buildings as man-made ecosystems. And I think part of an ecosystem is that things are intertwined. You know, the exhaust or the exhaling of an animal becomes the inhaling of a plant and vice versa. So in that sense, we've been trying to think a lot about synergies. So for instance, you mentioned the mountain. It's taking an apartment building and a parking structure. Rather than having them next to each other, we combine them so all of the apartments become houses with gardens sitting on top of a man-made mountain of cars. The 8 house mixes spaces for working, living, into creating almost like a townhouse community where you can walk and bicycle all the way to the penthouse. So it's really mixing things together that creates the possibilities for synergy and that maybe creates added value and a sort of a sustainable city that is not only more resource conscious, but also more enjoyable to inhabit.
30 seconds, what advice would you give to Dubai, Abu Dhabi, these Gulf states, when they're building these new cities? What advice would you give them? What should they be thinking about when designing buildings and urban spaces?
Yeah, but I think maybe one thing that one should question, because I mean, a lot of things in Dubai are being marketed under the idea of exclusivity. And I think there could be a huge potential in thinking about inclusivity. I think sustainable cities and lively cities are inclusive. And by actually combining things you would normally keep separate, you can actually create a much more dynamic and a much more lively and a much more sustainable city. So I think inclusivity rather than exclusivity could be an interesting direction.
Bjarke, thanks very much indeed. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure.
That's Bjarke Engels. He is the Danish architect who's building a space station in Mushrif Park.
Can't get enough of Dubai Eye? There's more at DubaiEye1038.com.
While staying loosely with construction, Brandy spoke to Shane Loom, who's co-founder of a company called Decibel Live. He told us about the new technology that would make a construction company that exceeds noise pollution automatically pay residents a Bitcoin fine.
Decibel Live is a blockchain-enabled company that does noise and environmental monitoring. So we use blockchain to provide instant and verifiable results. So if you compare it to the likes of a company where they might be making a noise emission and then they have someone that is impacted by that, often the company has to hire a noise consultant to prove their noise levels are what they believe they are, and then the person impacted by that or the group will hire their own noise consultants who will go out and come up with completely different answers. So the two of them don't meet in the middle, and we're taking out all those layers by having a direct interface in the way of a smart contract operating on the blockchain directly between the noise violator and those citizens that are impacted by it.
Okay, so let's pretend the noise violator is a construction site, which is not unknown in these parts.
I've read that.
What would happen?
So it can actually be initiated directly by the construction company themselves. They don't need to wait for the local government to approach them and say you should do this. They could actually create a contract tomorrow with us, and that contract can stipulate that between the hours of 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. at night, if they exceed 50 decibels in noise or 60 decibels in noise, then there'll be a payout. And that payout is over the blockchain, so we use a cryptocurrency for that. And that cryptocurrency enables citizens that are impacted by that noise to get instant compensation in the form of a cryptocurrency in their wallet.
Well, I like it, but yeah. Why would any construction company want to do that?
Well, they can do it to stave off the regulator because they can show that they actually care and that they're actually being proactive about approaching what is an effect of their construction. You know, the noise that they generate is often seen as an invisible byproduct, but it does actually impact a lot of people. And the World Health Organization has found that levels above 60 decibels can actually be very detrimental to your cardiovascular health. And at night, levels above 40 are extremely detrimental to you. So they can actually do it to be proactive and avoid the local authority doing it. But then maybe on the flip side, the local authority may say, actually, we want you to use this as a mechanism to help us enforce our regulations. So it doesn't actually just have to apply to a construction site. It can be a concert. It can be an Airbnb type company. You know, that if you are renting out a room on Airbnb, you want to make sure that the people renting that room are not going to throw a wild party and upset everyone that lives nearby. So there's quite a few broad applications that can be used.
So where is this being used at the moment? Who is using it?
So we have a trial that we're commencing with the City of Hague and a beach where they have a lot of concerts, much like we have here tonight, and a lot of late night revelers. So they're using it. They're putting in 31 of our sensors, and they will operate, and they'll provide them with a heat map of where the noise is actually occurring. And the contract will also mean that they can provide compensation to those residents nearby.
How much does it cost to put this kind of technology in place?
The cost is minimal. We provide the sensors. You can also use third-party equipment that link in with our system. But we have our own sensor that actually has the microphone, the noise level meter. It also has air pollution factor in it too. So we can monitor carbon monoxide levels, nitric oxide, and other air particles. So that's all built into the same unit. So the actual cost of the unit is coming down all the time. Once we get scale, it'll be down under $50 to buy the actual air monitoring unit.
So at the moment, you're mainly talking about noise, but it sounds like this can go a lot further. What other sort of circumstances could you see it being used in?
Okay, well, we aim to specialise in sensory data over the blockchain and providing smart contracts that work around that. So it could be used over air pollution, where the government or the local authority provide compensation, or it could be provided directly by those plants that are causing that air pollution. Another couple of areas that we've looked at are volume levels and bins. So once a bin gets up to a certain volume, it can trigger automatically that a pickup is required, and there can be a smart contract in place that actually covers the payment of that pickup. So really, the applications that we're touching on, we're just scraping on the surface at the moment. We see it being quite a large volume business that we've got.
What's the incentive, though, for the people who are making the noise or making the mess or polluting the river or whatever it happens to be in putting this in? Isn't it more in their interests to have some protracted court battle go back and forth where they don't have to pay out?
Well, sometimes those court battles can end up costing hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. There's a case down in New Zealand where a wind farm and the local residents, they have spent over $1 million in legal fees, and then the same amount again in noise consulting fees. So by having a proactive system like this in place right at the outset, they could have saved millions of dollars. There really are some huge benefits for companies to look at it.
The advantage of blockchain I can see in facilitating the cryptocurrency payments. Why else put it on blockchain though? Why does it need to be blockchain?
Well, the advantage of blockchain is that it can be instant. It can be verified by all parties. A blockchain is effectively a distributed ledger. So that ledger is verified by thousands of computers all over the world. So it is very secure. It can be trusted because it is used widespread for a number of applications. And the advantage of it being over the blockchain is the fact that it's visible instantly.
So quite the irony there that we had a live band start up behind us halfway through that interview talking about noise control. But do you know what else is really interesting about these guys? So I met the two founders, Shane and Vijay, of the two founders of this company, at lunchtime on the Saturday. But even though they have been in business together for a year and a half, they have customers, they have working technology, they actually only met each other about 2 hours before I met them.
That's weird.
You want to know how? This is how.
Vijay's based in Canada, and I'm from New Zealand, so we're at opposite ends of the world. We have just been accepted into the World Startup Factory in the Netherlands. They operate an accelerator program, and Vijay has been there for about the last 3 months, so he's part Dutch now, I guess you could say. It's actually really interesting. Today is the first day that we've actually met in person. Prior to that, we've spent the last year and a half having Google Hangouts and chatting to each other over video conference. We've got a Slack channel going where Vijay and I are active on it. We've got a few other people that are involved that have joined the team. So none of us have actually met until today where Vijay and I have met.
If this is the first time you guys have actually met in person, how did you first come across each other?
Came up with an idea, and I put a blog post out on a forum, on a cryptocurrency forum, which at the time, going back a year and a half ago, was filled by not many people at all. Vijay picked up on that post and he contacted me, and we've formed the company straight away on a virtual handshake, really.
It's like Tinder for geeks.
I know. That's the future. Two blokes run a successful company for a year and a half to the point that they've got business, they've made actual things, they've invented technology, never met.
Looking for a business partner, expertise, 5 years experience, need $500,000 of startup capital, swipe left.
Absolutely.
Can't get enough of Dubai Eye. There's more at DubaiEye1038.com.
And finally, Brandy spoke to Leanne Fry, Chief Innovation Officer at an organisation called AusTrac, Australia's financial intelligence agency. She told Brandy about an Australian initiative to get more women and more girls into technology.
We need that because a lot of these young women are not connected enough with the technology and the nuts and bolts of it. And we needed them to see what was under the covers, how they could actually create an app in 16 weeks. They coded, they marketed, they put a business plan together and researched an area of public good that they were passionate about. So it was multifaceted. It wasn't just the technology. It was actually showing them entrepreneurial skills, leadership skills, and that confidence. And the success at the end of it, when they looked at the app that they'd created, which was on the Google Play Store, was quite spectacular, because these were girls as young as about 9 right through to 15. So it's really just getting them to lift their heads up and take a look around and see what the future looks like, and giving them practical experience at participating. Often there's a barrier to participation for women, particularly in the STEM area. And while digital literacy is more than just STEM, any pathway in for the girls is valuable, and it's valuable experience that they can build on.
I think I first interviewed someone about getting more women in tech about 15 years ago. Why are people like you still the exception rather than the norm?
Well, it's interesting because my pathway to tech has come via a lot of other roles, and I love technology for what it's doing and how it shapes and how it's... So I wonder whether what we need to be encouraging women around is the potential benefits of technology rather than coming from a hardcore coding background. Especially in the new world, machines will code themselves. So some of those hard skills are less important than understanding what technology can do for the public good, for the private sector, for education, future of work. So I even call myself an interpretive service. I take what technology can do and make sense of it to business folk. And so they're some of the areas that I'm encouraging women in my team. I've got women from hardcore data scientists, through to testers, coders, engineers, project managers. But I think at schools still, there is still a bias for a lot of young women about science and technology. I've got a 15-year-old daughter who adores science, so I'm already talking technology and how she buys into all of that. But I think in schools they need to be actively encouraging the girls to move into there and understand what the roles available are. Sometimes they think it's all about coding. And it's not in this new world. It's a lot more than just coding.
To play devil's advocate, to look at it from the other side around, why does tech need women?
Good question. A whole lot of reasons. It's what makes a healthy organisation is that balance. And so what makes a healthy technical ecosystem is that balance of perspectives and the skills, different skills, but also the legitimacy of equality in the community. Women need to be at the table. Women need to be seen to be the decision makers, and they need to learn how to actively participate and stake their claim. It's a healthy organisation is a very well-balanced organisation, and that's not just gender, that's diversity, that's perspectives, and it's understanding the dynamic of that and making sure that you're true to that.
And that is Leanne Fry, Chief Innovation Officer and Chief Information Security Officer at Elstrac, also one of the mentors at Tech Girls Are Superheroes.
So that's it from our World Government Summit special podcast. Hope you made it all the way to the end. We found some fascinating content down there this week. Hope you enjoyed it.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.